Hello and welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. We release these episodes every week on Wednesday mornings, and the best way to support us is by clicking subscribe and taking a moment to rate the podcast wherever you are listening. If you'd like to support our efforts to keep the nonprofit Meditation Center open in Nashville, you can donate via Venmo by sending your donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can make a donation through our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, by clicking the Donate tab. And one final announcement, we are very excited to offer the Wild Heart Labor Day Weekend Loving Kindness Retreat at Heartwood Refuge in Hendersonville, North Carolina, on September 3rd through the 6th. If you'd like more information about this retreat, please visit wildheartmeditationcenter.org and click the Events tab, or you can sign up and learn more at heartwoodrefuge.org. Peace and love. Hope you enjoy.
Right. This morning, I wanted to offer a talk on the topic of truthfulness. Rachel and I have been sharing this series on the 10 paramis, which are written up on the board there. And this is a list in our lineage of Buddhism, which mostly draws from Theravada, which is kind of the old school Buddhism that kind of gave rise out of the time of the Buddha's life. That isn't that popular. It's definitely there. It's in the Pali Canon. It's a part of the teaching. But it's not one that's taught a ton in our tradition, which I think is kind of a shame, because I feel like for especially us as Westerners, it has a great way of consolidating all of the Buddhist teachings down into these core principles. And I don't know about you, but as you look at them up on the board, as I read through some of these, I feel like these are all principles that most of us could probably get behind with some ease. You know, they're not esoteric, they're not vague, they're not abstract, they're not existential in nature, they're very pragmatic, which I always feel like is really where the Buddha was aiming his teaching anyway. And so the paramis are sometimes translated as the perfections, the 10 perfections. But in knowing how well we as Westerners do with the word perfect, I think it's helpful to look at the etymology, like what does parami really mean from its root? And it comes from this word paramam, which literally translates to mean of utmost importance. So it means something more like a principle or a priority. So these are aspirations for our spiritual practice. They're things we want to try to prioritize and live by on a daily basis. And they are generosity, ethical conduct, or I like to just call it integrity, renunciation, wisdom, energy or effort, patience, truthfulness, resolve or determination, kindness, and equanimity. Those are the 10. And central to the Buddhist teachings, this idea that it's more than an idea, it's a practice that our happiness can't really come from the world outside of ourselves. And we all know this intellectually, right? Like, we're taught this at a young age, but we're not really modeled that in our world. You know, we know this, but we still take refuge in relationships and validation from outside of ourselves, and, you know, status and things that seem to give us security that are not able to permanently satisfy us. And so there's nothing wrong with those things in and of themselves, but this kind of quest for seeking happiness outside of ourselves is a dead end, is what the Buddha is saying. He says that in order to find a more sustainable happiness, maybe not a type of happiness that is as instantly gratifying and as much of a rush as some of those other things, but a more sustainable happiness, we need to really look at the principles that we in which we relate to the world. the principles in which we relate to the world, not what we can get from the world. So an interesting thing about the Buddhist teachings on mindfulness is that when we're practicing present time awareness, he encourages us to bring awareness to both the internal, the external, and both. And all of the instructions throughout the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness that were written or recorded over 2,600 years ago, he encourages us to practice mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind states, mindfulness of different categories of our experience, different patterns of our experience, internally, externally, and both. And when I was thinking about the paramis this morning, these 10 principles, I was thinking about how interesting it is that these are things that we practice inside of ourselves, internally, but also things that we bring out into our behavior to engage with the world, ways of relating to the world as well. Right? Like when we talked about generosity, we talked about what happens when we give too much of ourselves. We get out of balance, and our generosity towards ourselves gets covered up by our need to be of service to others. You know, and I was thinking about renunciation too. How do we practice this internally and externally? Well, externally, we practice looking at, for example, maybe some of the things that we consume. Not in this moralistic way or this performative social way, but just in a way in which what supports a meaningful life. And we practice some renunciation. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh calls it wise consumption. You know, monitoring how much we're taking in and, you know, how much money we really need and how many things we really need or experiences we really need to have. And we're just kind of curious about that. But we also practice renunciation internally. Renunciation just means letting go of what's not needed. And when I'm driving in the car caught in a resentment, that's usually based upon some projection I have of a person. I don't know about you, but when I get pissed at someone, my view of them becomes very narrow and definitive. You know, there's this kind of renunciation of mindfulness, of being able to kind of acknowledge the trance that I'm in and the story that I'm in the moment, and just tell the mind, I see you. Thanks for sharing, and not right now. Putting it down. And it may arise in the next moment, or 5 minutes from then, or 10 minutes from then, but this is the thing, is that it is a continual practice, internally and externally. Generosity, renunciation, kindness, kindness towards ourselves, kindness to others. All of these principles practiced internally and externally. And I think this is the same for truthfulness, which is what we're going to talk about today. I think it's even more distinct when it comes to truthfulness, because when I think of truthfulness, first thing I think of is telling the truth, being honest with other people, not lying. And I'd say that this is an ethical principle of the Buddhist teaching. And we'll talk about this later today, but I wanted to start with the internal practice of truthfulness, which I call stepping out of self-deception. Truthfulness that is a commitment to see things as they actually are. You know, maybe the hard truths of our shortcomings, of our reactivity, the hard truths of ways in which that we're tangled up with our attachments. Before we talk about stepping out of self-deception and practicing truthfulness internally, I want to back up and talk a little about truthfulness as a whole, because I think it can be a tricky subject, especially in religious traditions. We often look to our religious traditions to bring us some ease and comfort in navigating a realm of human existence that is uncertain and unpredictable in nature. We look to our religious traditions to define morality for us and to assure us that we're headed in the right direction. And in its most complacent manifestations, we can all too easily abandon the radical responsibility that we have of doing the work ourselves to investigate a skillful way to live in the world. Right? Instead, we give our responsibility over to dogma and to authority and to say, I'm going in the right direction because the dogma and the authority says so, because I believe this. And the interesting thing about Eastern traditions is it's not focused on orthodoxy. They don't give a shit what you believe in. Although our views inform our actions, it's not so much about belief as it is in practice. Every moment, the mind is doing something. Every moment, there's an opportunity to speak, to act, to behave, to relate. And every moment, we're operating from some assumptions based upon our experiences largely. And what the Buddha is doing is he is really empowering us to take that responsibility. And that mindfulness, present time awareness, gives us the possibility of tuning into what's happening and choosing how we want to relate. So I'm very wary of capital T truths and capital T teachers that teach capital T truths. Right, as if there's some type of truth out there that if someone was to exclaim it to you, you would get enlightened. The type of the truth that we seek in the Buddhist path is an experiential truth. It doesn't come from being handed the map of the dogma or the authority or the discipline, but it comes from navigating the map skillfully and walking the terrain. It comes through the experience of walking the walk, not talking the talk. And the only way to gain experiential wisdom is by walking. Walking the path. Checking in. What is it like now? Monitoring our perception, monitoring our emotional reactivity, monitoring our motivations behind what we're saying and doing in the world, monitoring behavior. And this type of truth, this wisdom principle of stepping out of self-deception, is not always good news. You know, I call this the rude awakening. You know, this path, the Buddhist path, is pretty fucking hard. You know, and I'm not saying that in a like level of challenge type of way, like intellectually hard, but it's hard because it doesn't allow us to rely on our intellect. It doesn't allow us to rely on an authority outside of ourselves. That it doesn't involve certainty. Actually, the core principle is that things are not permanent and certain, and therefore we have to be in the moment. And we have to really search for what is a skillful way of relating to that moment, a creative way to engage with things like death and loss and breakups and disappointments and betrayal and fear. And the cool thing that happens is we practice a little bit, we see, oh, the mind is a little bit more kind. You know, there's a little bit more space. There's a little bit more ease. It's less harsh in here. Stepping out of self-deception is the truthfulness that is trying to live in line with reality. And this reality is that life has a precarious nature to it. And I like the word precarious because it kind of summarizes two of the core teachings that the Buddha offer, which is the teaching on impermanence. And because things are impermanent, they're also not permanently reliable. So we have this kind of precarious existence where things are in flux, they're transient. There's not ever a place where we can say, I have arrived and I can relax content forever. We're constantly navigating, as the Buddha calls them, our lives' worldly winds. Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, status and disgrace. And impermanence is great news when things are shitty. You know, like sometimes I'm just like, I'm just going to wait this shit out. And it will change. And I don't have to do much of anything. Try not to be self-destructive, but if I just don't do that, things will change. Good news. But more challenging to accept when it's the loss of a loved one, you know, or when there is something that we have that we become separated from. We crave safety and security, but that is not guaranteed in this realm. And I would say, this is where I would add, because the younger Andrew would say, screw it all, burn it to the ground. Buddhism is nihilism. What's the point? It's all meaningless. It's all impermanent, impersonal, imperfect. No, we're held to the responsibility, if we want to find a way to have genuine happiness in this impermanent, imperfect, impersonal world, we have the responsibility to find a way to cultivate that safety and cultivate that security in something that doesn't require permanence. To cultivate it in principles. To cultivate it in the way that we relate to the world, not what we get from it. To show up, to be present, to be kind, to be compassionate. To try to speak what's true and useful and timely and kind, and to try to live with some integrity, and to try to practice awareness, equanimity. But because the world is impermanent, imperfect, impersonal, what usually arises for me is fear. Fear is very insidious. And when we look at it, fear is just a self-protective drive, you know, like the brain is trying to deal with the fact that we don't have a lot of control over a lot of things. And when the fear arises, reactivity arises. We try to fix, manage, control the world to our preferences. And the Buddha's saying something quite radical. He's saying that the first noble truth is not a capital T truth, but the practice, the lowercase t truth of the practice, is to embrace this vulnerability, to embrace the impermanent, imperfect, impersonal nature of our life. And this isn't easy, because everything in us sometimes resists that. I remember when I was when I was 18, I was still in active addiction, and I'd just gotten arrested, and I was staying at a friend's house. And that time of my life was really hazy, but I know I hadn't talked to family in like a couple weeks, and I was standing there in the kitchen getting high, and my half-sister called me from California. So I don't talk a lot to her. I didn't grow up with her, so I didn't know why she was calling. And I answered the phone, and she asked me how I was doing, and I kind of broke down and told her. It's this kind of weird moment of like desperation. And she said, "Do you need help?" And without thinking, I said yes. And I instantly regretted it. I instantly regretted it. And I think for me to say yes meant to simultaneously say that I'd screwed up. It was to confront the shame and regret that I felt. and to also acknowledge that I would then need to change the familiarity of living the way that I'd been living into something new and the unknown. So it meant both that I had to acknowledge the pain and harm that I caused myself and other people, and that I would then need to change if I acknowledged it. And so a lot of times I don't ask for help because I'm scared to change. You know, a lot of times I don't embrace the vulnerability of the pain that I'm going through because I'm scared of what it means about me and what I will have to do to get through it. I listened to this talk by a psychologist, can't remember her name right now, but she had talked about how what's interesting psychologically is people would rather settle for what's familiar than what brings them peace. Because familiarity is predictable, even if it's chaotic and destructive. And I realized that addiction for me was an attempt to, it was the only way that I could control the way that I felt. It was the only way that I could guarantee that I would feel different than the way that I did. And even though what I got was complete and utter chaos and destruction in my life, it was at least reliable in the sense that I could get out of how I felt in that moment. And I would take an endless list of destruction in my life and consequences in my life over the uncertainty of trying to find a different way to live in the world without the use of drugs and alcohol. So awareness isn't always good news, but good information, right? It's not good news to the ego, right? When we question something that we built up to be true, there's a crumbling of the defensive wall that we built up. And so I feel like truthfulness and humility go hand in hand. And humility is an interesting principle. I feel like humility is an ability to accept this vulnerability, that we are only human, and there is not something uniquely disastrous or monstrous about my shortcomings. You know, a lack of humility, I think, a lot of times comes from shame. If you knew me, if you knew my struggle, if you knew my pain, what would you think of me? And so, especially in our culture where shame is rampant, I mean, if it wasn't, Brené Brown wouldn't be a best-selling author. Something that is actually somewhat unique to our culture. When the Dalai Lama came to the U.S. for the first time 50 years ago or however long ago it was, someone asked him, hey, I have a lot of students that hate themselves, and what do we do when we're teaching meditation? And he went back and forth with his translator for like 15 minutes to try to figure out what hating yourself was. And he finally figured it out, and the only thing he said is he looked at this person, he goes, oh no, that's wrong. That's not the right view. I wish it was that easy, right? I think humility is about confronting that, right? Like that there's nothing so unique about our pain and suffering. You know, we get so caught up in the details of like, well, I did this and I said this, and, you know, and I think we even kind of promote like this Puritanism, this kind of demanding of perfection is really such an enemy to truthfulness. And so I really think embracing vulnerability is embracing imperfection. And I like to define that word dukkha, that stress, or you know, sometimes it's defined as suffering, which isn't quite accurate, but I like to define it as just imperfect. This world, this human experience, everything that we're in is imperfect. I heard Matthew Brensilver, he's quoting a different psychologist, and he had said that we think like scientists, but we tend to think like trial lawyers. He said, when a scientist does a controlled trial, they don't know what they'll find. In a controlled trial, you gather evidence, and then afterwards, you support a view with the evidence. In some cases, no dissing on trial lawyers. In some cases, when presenting a legal case, you actually do the opposite. You begin with a conclusion and then work your way backward to justify it. And we tend to think in that way. And I wanted to read something about this type of thinking. Again, I'm sorry, I don't have the source for this. I quoted it probably 7 years ago. Why is it so fun to be right? As pleasures go, it is, after all, a second-order one at best. Unlike many of life's other delights, chocolate, surfing, kissing, it does not enjoy any mainline access to our biochemistry. And yet the thrill of being right is undeniable, universal, and perhaps most oddly, almost entirely undiscriminating. We can't enjoy kissing just anyone, but we can relish being right about almost anything. Our indiscriminate enjoyment of being right is matched by an almost equally indiscriminate feeling that we are right. Most of us go through life assuming that we're basically right, basically all the time, about basically everything. As absurd as it sounds when we stop to think about it, our steady state seems to be one of unconsciously assuming that we are very close to omniscience. If we relish being right and regarded as our natural state, you can guess how we feel about being wrong. For one thing, we tend to view it as rare and bizarre, an inexplicable aberration in the normal order of things. For another, it leaves us feeling idiotic and ashamed. Of all the things we are wrong about, this idea of error might well top the list. It is our meta, M-E-T-A, mistake. We are wrong about what it means to be wrong. Far from being a sign of intellectual inferiority, the capacity to err is crucial to human cognition. Far from being a moral flaw, it is inextricable from some of our most humane and honorable qualities. And far from being a mark of indifference or intolerance, wrongness is a vital part of how we learn and change. Thanks to error, we can revise our understanding of ourselves and amend our ideas about the world. However disorienting, difficult, or humbling our mistakes might be, it is ultimately wrongness, not rightness, that can teach us who we are. In Zen Buddhism, they say, in the expert's mind, there are few possibilities, but in the beginner's, there are many. I believe it was Suzuki Roshi when asked, I may be wrong about that, to summarize the teachings in a simple, concise way by one of his students after years and years of sitting with him, saying, I just can't wrap my head around this stuff. He said, give it to me in a nutshell. And he said, not always so, not always so. Things can't be predictable. They can't be certain. We can't be right about a world that's constantly changing. We can't be right about an experience that we're having that's constantly changing, about a body that's constantly aging, about moments of illness, about death. We can't be right about those things. Religion shouldn't have to give us the answer to those things, but the tools to deal with those things. My belief, my view, is that that's what it's for. That's what community's for. It doesn't even have to come from religion. It can come from our secular communities. It should be about being vulnerable. It should be about living with an undefended heart, about not demanding perfection out of ourselves, and helping each other get through it. So I'm not going to talk about the ethical principle of truthfulness, as in not lying, today. although that's an aspect of integrity that Rachel covered probably in our second week. Practicing living by principles. So I just want to close with a quote by Ajahn Sucitto. I thought it was a really great way to wrap up this discussion on stepping out of self-deception and the truthfulness that is the wisdom principle of seeing things clearly in actuality. Ajahn Sucitto says, "Being honest about our reactive habits, our shortcomings, and our stubbornness leads us to inquire as to what keeps us bound to these unsatisfactory ways of operating." And with that sense of inquiry, as we step back from engaging in these reactions and just look into them rather than condemning or justifying them, we find some intimate wisdom, clarity, and light. We know there is no point in operating through these forms of reactivity because that either supports the wall that we build against life or keeps us running on automatic. However, every time we step back and review ourselves, there can be this steady, "this is how it is" kind of wisdom, a wise seeing that lessens how personally we take our shortcomings. After all, there's nothing so uniquely me about having a personality with its faults and limitations. This is everyone's work. In this way, these two functions of meditation, the ability to step back and the ability to look into the experience intimately, go together and support each other.